Welcome back to On the Case, the podcast. I'm Paula Zahn, and thanks for joining us for Episode 3, In the Shadows of Home. Tonight, we're on the case in Las Vegas, Nevada. One of the world's most popular tourist destinations suddenly became the backdrop for a shocking mystery when high school student Alyssa Otremba vanished just steps away from her home. Police and her family launched a frantic search to find her, but the trail of clues they discovered would ultimately lead them to the darkest depths of human nature. September 2nd, 2011. It was late in the afternoon on the Friday of Labor Day weekend when Jennifer Otremba got a call from her 15-year-old daughter, Alyssa. The teenager asked her for permission to meet her classmate, Cody, to borrow a book so she could do her homework.
She was pretty adamant about getting that textbook on Friday so that she could get all the work done, so then she had the three-day weekend to enjoy.
Alyssa's mom hadn't met Cody before, and at the time, Jennifer was also a little concerned about how far her daughter would have to walk. But Alyssa said she would be home before it got dark.
So there was no reason for me to really worry. She was 15 years old, and it wasn't a dangerous area. It was light outside, the sun was still up.
Plus, Alyssa was a responsible teenager who was good about checking in with her mother, which she did later that night.
She texted me at 6:38 p.m. and it said, "I'm walking down Grand Teton," which is a main street in our neighborhood. She says, "My phone's about to die. I'll be home in a half an hour."
Jennifer texted Alyssa 30 minutes later, but got no response. She called home and her younger daughter, Megan, answered.
And I was like, "Is Alyssa home yet?" And she said, "No." And so it was odd. Something just didn't feel right.
Jennifer raced home, worried that something had happened to Alyssa.
I had been calling Alyssa's phone, and she wasn't answering.
By the time she reached her house, Jennifer was panicked. Alyssa's sister, Megan Otremba.
When she came home, and I could see it in her eyes, how scared she was. And so then that's when I started to worry.
Alyssa's mother made a flurry of calls trying to locate her daughter, while Megan used a computer program trying to track her sister's phone. Neither of those efforts brought them any closer to finding her. But Megan finally was able to reach Alyssa's classmate, Cody.
She contacted him and just said, "Hey, what happened?" And he didn't have any answers for us.
In fact, Cody claimed he never met Alyssa that afternoon.
He said, "I never made it. My parents weren't home, and so I couldn't leave the house." That's when panic kind of set in, so I called the police at that point.
It was around 10 p.m. when Alyssa's mother reported that her daughter was missing. Then Jennifer called local hospitals and quickly assembled her own search party.
I did contact some other friends. We were able to print up a bunch of flyers.
The frantic search for the teenager continued throughout the night and into the next day. Despite being terrified and emotionally drained, Jennifer vowed not to sleep until she found her daughter.
I drove around, and then I was talking to other people. "Hey, have you seen a girl?" I just was sort of at a loss, and it's like, what do? But you can't stop.
But a little more than 24 hours after Alyssa vanished, Jennifer got a chilling phone call.
a friend of mine said, the police are here. They found a burned body in the lot behind your house.
At first, Jennifer couldn't even process what those horrifying words really meant. But as she raced to the undeveloped land behind her home, the reality of the situation began to sink in.
My body went numb from the neck down. I couldn't move anything, and then I couldn't breathe.
Officers refused to allow Jennifer to approach the cordoned-off area where the body had been found. But even though she couldn't see her daughter, Jennifer knew that her search had come to a heartbreaking conclusion.
There was no question in my mind that it was her.
As detectives continued to sift through clues at the crime scene, they also had the grim task of asking Alyssa's mother for her teenager's dental records. Unfortunately, they would be the only way the medical examiner could positively identify the badly burned body. Testing ultimately confirmed what Jennifer Otremba already knew in her heart. The victim had, in fact, been her 15-year-old daughter. The Alyssa Otremba missing persons case had just become a homicide investigation.
It's so surreal. You're just a normal family, and just all of a sudden your world flips upside down and it shatters into a million pieces.
Just days earlier, Alyssa had begun classes at a new high school after having been homeschooled the year before.
She was thrilled to go to a high school. She would tell kids, I just got out of prison, and they look at her and she goes, well, it was homeschool, but you know, it's kind of the same thing. She just was so excited.
Alyssa was a witty 15-year-old who made friends easily and enjoyed making people laugh.
She loved to have fun. There were many times that I was trying to punish her for something, and she thought if she could make me laugh, then everything was okay because she was so funny.
She had been a loving mentor and best friend to her younger sister, Megan.
They told me that they had found a body and that Alyssa was dead. Like, I couldn't believe it. And then I started crying. But it still didn't hit me that she wouldn't come home, that I would never see her again.
Jennifer also had to break the terrible news to her husband, Scott, who was overseas on assignment in the military.
My husband knew that she was missing, but he didn't know that we had found her.
Jennifer was still in shock during that heart-wrenching phone call.
I was just numb. So much of what went through my head was, what happened? I didn't understand it.
Jennifer had become convinced that the only way she could truly accept that her daughter had been murdered was to see her body.
I needed to put some pieces together. And so against a lot of opinions, I went down to the mortuary.
Due to the condition of Alyssa's body, the morgue was only able to show Jennifer one of her daughter's feet, which was covered by a sock.
I just needed to see that. I needed to put that in that place. And it's kind of bizarre, but I laid on her and I just cried. I didn't want to leave her.
While Jennifer and the rest of her family tried to come to terms with their unimaginable loss, Las Vegas Metro Police Detective Dan Long was beginning the difficult task of finding Alyssa's killer. He raced to the scene after receiving a disturbing call from his lieutenant.
He said that they had a young white female that was burned. She was naked from the waist down, that they suspected rape.
forensic specialists confirmed that theory and recovered biological evidence despite the brutal way Alyssa's killer had attempted to cover up his crime.
I smelled gasoline at the scene. Her face, her hands, chest area were burned extensively. So obviously he's trying to destroy evidence.
Long was an experienced homicide investigator, but nothing in his career could have prepared him for the brutality that had been inflicted upon the innocent 15-year-old.
It was a nightmare. It was horrific.
The detective carefully surveyed the scene.
It's a 32-acre vacant lot adjacent to a housing complex. She was in a carved-out area like a ditch, so she's not visible from the street. She's laying on her back. She has no pants on, and there are stab wounds.
An autopsy revealed that those stab wounds had been the cause of Alyssa's death. Her body had been set on fire after the murder. Alyssa's killer had also burned her white tank top and jeans, and one of her distinctive green sneakers was found a few steps away from her body. Police were deeply troubled that it appeared that the entire terrifying attack had taken place in the shadow of Alyssa's neighborhood, just steps away from her home. Due to the proximity of the crime scene to her housing complex, investigators felt that someone must have seen or heard something.
We had detectives in the backyard of every single house, talking to every single person that was adjacent to that vacant lot. We then expanded the crime scene to anything in that area.
Surprisingly, the neighborhood canvas didn't yield a single clue.
People are in their own homes doing their own thing. Sometimes they hear and see things. A lot of times they don't.
Unfortunately, this appeared to be one of those times. Back at the crime scene, investigators were busy gathering anything that could have been connected to Alyssa's killer.
Everything in that vacant lot was looked at, and we impounded quite a few things. We found some costume jewelry. There were Coke bottles, cigarette butts, everything that was not from that vacant lot was collected.
Investigators were convinced they were on the hunt for a brazen sexual predator. And the utter depravity of the attack suggested that Alyssa wouldn't be his last victim. On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment. Detectives were under a tremendous amount of pressure to solve the crime and get a potential serial killer off the streets. Investigators had begun to weave together several of the clues they discovered into a theory of the crime. In particular, the extreme level of violence used against Alyssa led detectives to believe the attack might have been a crime of passion. Detective Dan Long.
The victim is usually attacked by somebody close to her. So you're thinking we have to look at the boyfriends, ex-boyfriends, and then move our way out.
But interviews with those closest to Alyssa forced officers to reconsider. After a thorough investigation, they determined that the young teenager was not romantically involved with anyone near the time of her death.
They learned that she didn't have a current boyfriend.
In fact, Alyssa wouldn't have had much time to make new friends in the area.
She had been homeschooled the year before. She had been to her first week of school at Arborview High School.
Alyssa's sister, Megan Otremba.
She had gone there for 4 days. She didn't know very many people, but the people she knew, they liked her and she liked them. There was no one at school that I could have possibly imagined hurting her.
Megan had been the last one in her family to see Alyssa, and she will never forget their parting words.
Right before she walked out of the door, I told her that I loved her. And she told me that she loved me too. We didn't always say that, so I'm extremely grateful that that is the last thing that she heard me say to her, was that I loved her.
On the night Alyssa disappeared, her classmate told Megan that he and her sister had never met to exchange the book, but detectives were skeptical.
We sent detectives immediately to the classmate's house. He was a suspect.
But investigators quickly determined that Cody was telling the truth. Detective Robert Wilson.
The detectives were able to verify that he hadn't left the house.
Cody told police that he had let Alyssa know that he couldn't meet her around 6 that night. Alyssa then texted her mother at 6:38, stating that her cell phone was dying and that she'd be home by 7.
She told her, "I'm on Grand Teton." Last time her mother heard from her.
Based on Alyssa's last known location, authorities suspected that the teenager had taken a shortcut using a tunnel that ran under the highway.
These are the pedestrian tunnels under the freeway that Alyssa would have walked through.
The tunnel led to the vacant lot where Alyssa's body was ultimately found. It was a well-traveled corridor the teenagers used to get from one side of the freeway to the other.
It's much easier to go through these tunnels than go over the bridge. Everybody that lived on the west side of the freeways used those tunnels to go to and from school.
When investigators followed the path Alyssa would have taken from the tunnel to her home, they found more evidence that supported their theory. A trail of blood starting near the gate to her community that led to where her body was found.
The sidewalk is where we found the first drops of blood leading out into the vacant lot.
The bleeding was very light, and as the trail progressed to where we found her, it became thicker in volume.
The new evidence added to the haunting picture police had already discovered. Alyssa had been even closer to safety than detectives had originally thought. In fact, based on the blood drops, it was clear Alyssa was standing directly outside the gate of her housing complex when she was confronted by her attacker.
She was forced, probably at knife point, to the spot where the rest of the attack took place.
The medical examiner's report added more disturbing details. Alyssa had suffered more than 80 stab wounds, many of which appeared to have been inflicted simply to terrify the teenager.
She was tortured for somebody's pleasure.
The medical examiner found several defensive wounds on Alyssa's body, indicating that she had fought her attacker. But when the torment was over, he savagely killed Alyssa.
She did take a wound to the chest, into the lung, that was fatal. We did find a triangular-shaped tip of the knife embedded in her skull.
The fact that part of the murder weapon was still lodged in the teenager's skull left little doubt about how much rage and force was used during the sadistic assault.
That's a lot of force. It didn't go into her brain, but it did go into her skull.
Biological evidence recovered during the autopsy was used to create a DNA profile of the killer, and it was entered into the CODIS database. Unfortunately, there were no hits.
Nobody matched the profile.
Investigators re-canvassed the entire route Alyssa took home, looking for anyone who might have seen the teenager.
And it was an exhaustive search.
But police never found a witness that actually saw Alyssa after 6:30 that night. Although the investigation had just begun, detectives were already desperate for a lead.
We had nothing else to go on.
What we were dealing with is the worst thing that we could think of. We have a truly innocent victim in an area that she should not be dead. We knew that there was going to be a lot of pressure.
And that pressure was quickly reaching a boiling point. Just 24 hours after Alyssa Otremba's body was found, the community where she once lived was on edge. Parents felt the streets wouldn't be safe for their children until her killer was behind bars. Investigators agreed. They feared whoever had killed Alyssa was bound to strike again.
That was something we definitely talked about.
Detectives decided to release selective details about Alyssa's murder to the media, including information about the tunnels where she may have crossed paths with her killer. The police hotline was flooded with calls.
There were a lot of tips. If a car pulled over to a young girl on Grand Teton and asked for directions, we tracked that down. If a car pulled over near the vacant lot and the trunk was open, we ran that down.
And the most promising call came from a young woman who had read about the murder online.
Caller was an 18-year-old female. Her name was Elizabeth Morales. She said, "I know who killed this girl."
Her chilling words immediately hit a nerve with those working on the case.
We dropped all the other tips and went directly to speak to her.
Elizabeth met police at a gas station not far from the crime scene. She was nervous, but determined to tell them her story. Police quickly started peppering her with questions.
They were asking me to explain everything that happened.
While the teenager was intimidated, she put her fear aside to share what she knew.
Back of my head, the only thing I was thinking about was the victim's family.
Elizabeth's story began on the night Alyssa disappeared. She had been out on a date with her boyfriend, Danny, and one of his friends, Javier, kept calling nonstop.
He called him maybe like 20 times before Danny finally picked up, and he informed him that he needed him.
When Elizabeth's boyfriend got off the call, he abruptly ended their date. He said that Javier had a problem and had insisted that Danny meet him alone. Elizabeth was confused, but when they arrived at her house a few minutes later, Danny whispered a few words she will never forget.
"I think he might have killed somebody."
Elizabeth was stunned by her boyfriend's comment, and it kept her awake the rest of the night.
I couldn't sleep. I just had this heavy feeling in my chest. The only thing I could think was, why would he want to meet up with him? Why go over?
And the answers to those questions became even more troubling the next morning, when Elizabeth read that the body of a young girl had been found in an empty lot near the tunnels. Elizabeth was certain it was connected to Danny's mysterious conversation with Javier.
And I'm sitting there crying because I just felt like I knew something and nobody's saying anything about it. I'm just like, no, that can't happen.
Elizabeth told detectives she only knew Javier by his first name. And from the beginning, her boyfriend had warned her that he was dangerous. In fact, he was adamant that she stayed away from him.
Dan was just like, don't you ever hang out with him by yourself. And I was just like, why are you hanging out with him then?
Despite his strong words of caution, Danny continued to spend time with Javier. And when Elizabeth asked why, his answer was unsettling.
He says because it was his best friend. And I was like, okay, that still doesn't make any sense.
And Elizabeth wasn't done. She told police that she believed that Alyssa wasn't the first teenager Javier had hurt. She was now convinced that he was also responsible for the attack on a 15-year-old girl a few months before the murder.
She was actually my little brother's friend. She was going through the tunnels, and within that time, somebody had attacked her.
The young girl survived after her friends rushed into the tunnel and saved her.
My little brother's friends, they ran in and he let her go.
Following that attack, a composite sketch of the suspect was created. Detective Robert Wilson.
Hispanic male, young, short hair, wearing a baseball cap. 17 to 19 years old, maybe.
Elizabeth told investigators that when she first saw the poster in her neighborhood, she didn't want to believe it was Javier. But after Danny's mysterious phone call and Alyssa's tragic murder, Elizabeth now saw the chilling resemblance to him.
The way she described him, knowing that he is familiar with those tunnels, it made sense. It has to be him.
As Elizabeth shared her suspicions with police, she was aware that by coming forward, she was putting her life in danger.
It hit me really hard. Like, what's gonna happen after I say something? That shouldn't matter. I feel everybody should do the same thing.
When Elizabeth finished her story, investigators were impressed by her courage and her theories of both crimes.
You don't want to lock yourself into anything, but my partner and I talked that this is very possible a connection.
Detective Dan Long and his partner told Elizabeth they would have to talk with her boyfriend Danny, but they would not reveal the source of their information.
We told her we would go make contact and say, hey, we've developed you in another way, but we need to talk to you, Danny. She goes, oh no, you tell him I sent you and that you need to talk to him because of what I told you.
Investigators were amazed that Elizabeth was willing to risk her own safety by coming forward and by telling police to let her boyfriend know she was the one who had given them the information.
Smart, very smart girl, hugely courageous. She's my hero.
More on The Case, the podcast, after this. Police took Elizabeth home and immediately went to find her boyfriend at his place of employment. When detectives confronted Elizabeth's boyfriend, Danny, he didn't seem at all surprised to see them. Detective Dan Long.
He asked for permission. He came out and didn't ask what we were there for.
The detectives had no time to waste.
We actually asked him if he had a friend by the name of Javier.
Initially, Danny seemed unwilling to talk.
At first, he says he knew nothing.
Then investigators explained that his girlfriend Elizabeth had sent them, and he could face jail time if he lied.
At that point, he's realizing, I don't want to go down, and then he started to open up. And at that point, we just said, okay, we're going to do an interview. You're going to tell us everything. If you lie about anything to us, you're going to hurt yourself.
Danny quickly confirmed Elizabeth's story about getting a call from Javier on the night of Alyssa's murder.
He admitted that Javier said that he really messed up, that he might have murdered somebody, that he needed his help. Danny says he didn't believe Javier because Javier, he's known Javier for a long time, and Javier makes up stuff all the time.
Still, Danny ended his date, dropped Elizabeth off at home, and raced to Javier's house.
He said, usually they meet and it's a big old high five and what's going on, bro, and, you know, hugs. But this time Javier was like, shh, don't wake up my family, and took him to the back of the house.
Javier then repeated the chilling words he had said to Danny on the phone, this time adding more disturbing details.
He said he killed a little girl and that she's in the desert. He asked for money. He asked for help. Danny says he still thinks he's goofing, but now he's becoming scared.
Danny ultimately agreed to drive Javier to a convenience store. He said his friend was carrying a small black duffel bag and borrowed money from him to fill a can with gas. Danny claimed that during the car ride, he became extremely uncomfortable and was unsure how to get out of the situation.
At that point, he's starting to feel sick. He's starting to feel nauseous. This is his best friend. He's trying to find a way out.
Danny showed police where he and Javier went next. The edge of the vacant lot where Alyssa's body had been found.
The location he took us to was the start of the blood trail. That was the location where he stopped.
Danny claimed it was only then that he became certain that his best friend Javier had actually killed a young girl, and that he was returning there to burn her body.
At that point, he's like, do I run? What do I do? This is his best friend. Then all of a sudden, he's afraid of him. He's going through an emotional roller coaster. He doesn't know if I say no, is Javier going to hurt him? Javier is, are you going to come help me? And Danny goes, I love you, bro. I've got to go. And he drove away.
Danny's story confirmed everything his girlfriend Elizabeth had suspected and made Javier Righetti the prime suspect in Alyssa's murder. Detective Robert Wilson.
We were on the right track. Javier was the one.
Detectives were convinced that Elizabeth's boyfriend played no role in the crime.
Well, I believe Elizabeth. So if I believe Elizabeth, then Danny is with Elizabeth at the time of the murder.
They believed he never saw the body and hadn't helped to destroy any evidence.
From the location that we were at, you can't see the body because it is in a ditch. The big question that we had is, why aren't you calling the police?
When confronted with that tough question, Danny explained that he didn't want to believe that Javier was capable of killing someone.
He's crying and telling us that that's his best friend and that he loves him, and he's still holding out hope that he didn't do this.
Despite not reporting the suspicious encounter or Javier's confession, ultimately, Danny was not charged with any crime. Elizabeth Morales.
After that, I cut ties. I didn't talk to him, nothing.
After the visit to the crime scene, Danny led detectives to Javier Righetti's home. And just moments after they arrived, investigators got an urgent call. Alyssa's missing cell phone, which had been inactive since her murder, had been turned on just steps from where they were parked. Police sprung into action.
We have undercover detectives on the streets all over the place. We had tons of patrol, every asset we could get our hands on.
SWAT teams surrounded Righetti's residence, and they were prepared for an assault.
We're set and ready to go. They're in two armored vehicles. They park in front of the house. We have the entire perimeter covered, and they call for everybody to come out of the house with their hands up.
Seconds later, their 19-year-old suspect slowly walked out with his hands in the air. Detectives were stunned by his appearance.
What struck me when he was walking to me was, this is the man from the sketch. This is the man from the rape in the tunnels. It's an exact match.
19-year-old Javier Righetti was quickly placed under arrest. The teenager had a sizable wound on his hand, and he was ready to talk.
The SWAT presence was impressive enough to him to where he was like, I'll tell you what's going on. And that was part of our intent.
As soon as the young man got into the patrol car, he asked the detectives a strange question about Alyssa's murder.
Very first thing Javier said was, have you ever seen anything as horrible as this? So he's wanting to tell us. He wants to know what we think of him. And then we drove to our offices to sit down and do a video and audio recorded interview.
Once inside the interrogation room, Righetti made a full confession. Prosecutor Giancarlo Pesci believed there was a reason the teenager was so detailed in his account.
I think he was wanting to tell people. I think there's a layer to his personality that wants to take some pleasure from recounting what he had done.
He's very detached. I was at home, I was bored, I got a knife. I saw this girl walking down the street, she had an iPhone. He starts walking up behind her, but she's moving fast. She's looking back at him, then right as she makes it to the gate, he attacks.
The tunnel's right here, right? They right here is the complex, right?
Okay.
So I followed her. I grabbed her, raped her, and killed her, and took the phone.
How old do you think she was?
Probably really young.
Okay. All right. How many times do you think you stabbed her?
Probably about like 10.
Okay. Could it be more than that?
Probably a little bit more. And that's why the knife, it's all bent.
Righetti told police he had followed Alyssa nearly a half a mile with a knife in his hand.
He says he has the knife out. So he says that she looks back at him. She had to have seen it. That's a big knife. I can't even imagine what she went through.
After the murder, he said he ran covered in blood through the tunnels. He then climbed over a fence into someone's backyard.
He finds a house and then bathes in this residential pool to get the blood off of him. He takes the shirt off that he's wearing, washes the shirt, washes his pants in the swimming pool, and then runs home soaking wet to his house. That's when he starts calling Danny.
Police said the emotion Righetti displayed was over his fear of going to jail. None of the tears he shed were for Alyssa. During the interview, Righetti freely admitted he had tortured the young girl.
He has fantasized about this. He's a sociopath. Is he a serial killer in the making? I would say yes. I think he would have gotten a taste for this, and he would have continued.
In fact, Righetti admitted to other violent crimes, including the attack in the tunnels a few months before Alyssa's murder.
He tells us that he started raping when he was 12 years old.
Righetti then told detectives where they could find the evidence from Alyssa's murder, in a duffel bag he had hidden in his house.
All the evidence is there. Bloody jeans and my bloody shirt.
Is this the duffel bag that's in the ceiling?
Yes, sir.
Along with the bloodstained clothing, investigators found a mangled knife. Forensic testing revealed it was, in fact, the murder weapon. Police even obtained surveillance video of Javier's stop at the gas station on the night of the murder.
The video surveillance was pretty chilling. It shows him casually walking in just a few hours after brutally raping and murdering her and purchasing gasoline so he could light her on fire to try to hide what he had done.
Javier Righetti was charged with Alyssa's murder. Detectives contacted Jennifer Otremba with the news.
I got a phone call from a police sergeant, and he said, I just want you to know that we've arrested the guy that did this. And I was like, are you sure? And he said, yes.
Alyssa's sister, Megan Otremba.
I remember someone had said that they caught a guy, and so we all hugged and cried.
I was very relieved because it's scary to think that somebody that could do something like that is walking the streets.
Alyssa's family was also incredibly grateful to the young woman who helped solve the case.
I think she's absolutely amazing for what she did. It takes such a huge amount of courage to do something like that. It made me realize that anyone can help. They just have to have the courage to pick up the phone or talk to somebody.
I'm very appreciative of what she did because had she not called, nothing could have been done.
Investigators agree. They were amazed by the way Elizabeth Morales was able to connect the attack in the tunnels to Alyssa's murder.
I think it speaks volumes of her character. To be able to have the wherewithal to make the recognition that this could be this situation and then throw caution to the wind and just call the police. She saw something and she was not going to let it go by.
It could have been me. What if I didn't say anything? What if I know something and it can be stopped right now? It's scary to actually go forward with it. But at the end of the day, you're helping somebody else that's suffering.
In March of 2017, Javier Righetti was tried for the murder of Alyssa Otremba. Prosecutor Giancarlo Pesci knew the case would be a particularly heart-wrenching one for jurors.
You know, all murder's bad, but some are worse than others. Based on the victim. When you have a completely innocent victim, it's a young woman who's trying to get a book. It just tears on your heartstrings. Every parent's worst nightmare is the idea that their daughter's going to go out and never come home.
After days of emotional testimony, jurors took less than 3 hours to find Righetti guilty.
There was a huge weight off my shoulders. Because half of the battle was over. I mean, we still had the penalty phase, but half of the battle was over and done with.
During the penalty phase, several of Righetti's victims, including the young woman he attacked in the tunnels, took the stand. Their testimony painted a shocking portrait of a monster.
You could see the escalation in his behavior. There was a lot of similarities, and it was very haunting.
But I watched the girls that would testify, and it was extremely impactful. There wasn't a dry eye in there. And Javier showed no emotion at all.
Jennifer Otremba also took to the stand.
We just wanted to bring Alyssa to life. The jury got to sit and listen to days of how he tortured and killed her. And they didn't know the amazing person that she was. And so that was our job, to let them know what the world is missing out on now.
Javier Righetti was ultimately sentenced to death. For Detective Dan Long, the dangerous criminal got exactly what he deserved.
death row is the perfect place for him. That's where he needs to be.
The verdict brought Alyssa's family relief, but it did little to ease their pain.
She was just such a great person. She was going to make an impact in the world, and he took that away. Life is precious, and you don't know when it's over.
It tore my mother apart. She went to bed for a few years because that's all she could do. It's hard to watch the people close to you become so broken. And that's what really bothers me, is that it has torn all of us apart.
Alyssa's devastating murder has left the Otremba family with a void that will never be filled.
Alyssa was the sunshine of our family. She would bring us all together. She was and is my hero. And it's hard going on without my best friend.
...24-year-old Javier Rigetti is the youngest person on Nevada's death row, and he may be there a long time. The state hasn't executed a prisoner since 2006. Please join us again next time when we're back on the case.